Sarah, I actually want to ask about UFOs. Several media reports this week disclosed that...
What's up?
I was going to say, I don't know if that's a coincidence or not. I feel like I already want to pass on this question, given that you've got aliens sitting among you.
Several media reports disclosed the existence of a secret Pentagon program that was researching UFOs. Funding ran out for that in 2012. Does the president believe in the existence of UFOs, and would he be interested in restoring funding for that program?
Somehow that question hasn't come up in our back and forth over the last couple days, but I will check into that and be happy to circle back.
Three very mysterious shiny lights over Breckenridge have police and residents puzzled. Just before noon today, law enforcement agencies started getting reports of UFOs. 9 News Mountain Newsroom reporter Matt Renew is joining us from Breckenridge. And Matt, many people saw these objects today, including yourself.
Look at this, Scully. There's been another unsubstantiated UFO sighting in the heartland of America. We've got to get there right away.
I saw this illumination that was moving with respect to the stars. We were smart enough to not say, Houston, there's a light out there that's following us. So technically, it becomes an unidentified flying object.
While Neil and Buzz were on the lunar surface, Neil switched to the medical channel and spoke directly with the chief medical officer, saying, they're here, they're parked on the side of the crater, they're watching us.
All right, Beatrice, there was no alien. The flash of light you saw in the sky was not a UFO. Swamp gas from a weather balloon was trapped in a thermal pocket and refracted the light from Venus.
What the hell was that? He is under alien control. That thing in his butt is linked up to the visitor.
Son of a bitch.
Really?
Really? I am just a figment of your imagination.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
When we hear about alien sightings and abductions, we usually get these tales from local yokels. We don't often hear from the chief neurosurgeon who spotted a flying saucer on his way home. We've come to expect these stories from someone who came in from a night out drinking or a professional UFO chaser, not your average middle-class educated American. At the same time, if you ask your average American, they would tell you, on the whole, that we would be very arrogant to think that we're alone in this vast universe, that we're the only beings capable of our level of thought and awareness. So why do they never see UFOs or aliens? Where are their accounts on the news? Me, myself, I'm like Mulder. I want to believe, and yet I haven't seen anything to prove that they are out there. In this day and age of awareness, it seems absolutely logical on paper to believe aliens are there and might want to check us out. So why do we talk about them in hushed tones or tack a joke onto any mention of them? Why do we associate the guy with crazy hair on Ancient Aliens with your average alien conspiracy theorist? Even Robbie Williams knows not to talk about his alien chasing anymore because it's bad for business.
Maybe what makes it harder to fathom is that through years of obfuscation and denials, we, your average layman, don't even know what we don't know. It says a lot that terms like ET or UFO are themselves basic and vague. Extraterrestrial could just as easily describe a meteor, and UFO is anything in the sky we don't immediately recognize. If physicists have theorized that there are 11 simultaneous dimensions with our limited senses, who's to say what's going on around us and what we're missing out on?
One of the pillars of fear is not understanding, and I can't think of a subject we as mankind know less about. So when we get glimpses, whether they're sightings, recorded videos, or unearthly alloys not of this world, some people will be skeptical, and some will be scared. We now have declassified info from the FBI available to everyone to check out. What definitive proof will we need to say, maybe there's aliens, and not feel self-conscious about it? But in this day and age of recording everything, why don't we have more info than we did in the 50s? Why nothing definitive? I want to believe, but what makes it so hard? at any time, Netflix or Amazon Prime has about 20 or 30 different documentaries about aliens, abductions, and UFOs. And the History Channel always seems to be playing ancient aliens. Aliens and UFOs are already in our mainstream thought. So, like, why do we still doubt and side-eye everyone who talks about it?
There's a type.
There is, right? This week, we're going to talk about Fire in the Sky. It's a pretty liberal account of Travis Walton's story of his abduction in the 70s and 1989's Communion, which is Whitley Strieber's firsthand account. Where Travis Walton says that his encounters were definitely alien beings, Strieber has a different take on his encounter and suggests that it's supernatural, not exactly extraterrestrial.
Yeah, you're going to hold that one against me for a long time coming.
For a long time. Not even that really funny Saturday Night Live skit can make up for it, which was very funny.
Kate McKinnon is an American treasure.
She is an American treasure.
We were talking about how excited we are to cover this material. And in terms of horror, it's not a subject matter that frightens me.
I actually grew up terrified of aliens.
You did because of
X-Files? I was terrified of E.T.
Oh.
The movie E.T. scared the shit out of me.
It has its moments, yeah.
Yeah, it was very scary to me. And then growing up with Unsolved Mysteries, which most of them have to deal with alien stuff in Unsolved Mysteries, and that's always scared the shit out of me.
Okay, so this is like one of the genres that taps into something for you.
Oh, yeah, I was terrified of aliens growing up.
Yeah, I didn't realize that like it is a sticking point for a lot of people. I mentioned it to a friend of mine that this is the subject we're going to be covering. And, like, he's a cop in Central Jersey. Like, he's seen some shit.
Uh-huh.
And aliens are what unsettles him.
Really?
Yeah.
And then I have friends who really believe in aliens, say that they've seen flying UFOs.
This
and
same
stuff
friend
like that.
Has seen a UFO.
Yeah, and they're dead
on
serious
the job,
about it.
No less. On the job. He works the overnight. And when he saw lights in the sky hovering, like logic would dictate that they were drones of some sort, but he said it was without sound and it would do the like hover, dart fast, hover, dart fast. And he calls a fellow cop on the job and says like switch over to the private line, and once they're on a different frequency, He asked the guy to come to where he is because he needs a second set of eyes on this thing. And the dude shows up and the fucking drone UFO is still there. And now they're two cops in Central Jersey watching a UFO hover.
That's amazing.
It's pretty wild.
So I was walking down the street and I was thinking about this. I've been thinking a lot about this episode, apparently. and I was thinking, you know, I am definitely Mulder. You know, like, yeah. I want to believe this stuff. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, everyone wants to be Mulder. Mulder's the cool one. And then I thought, maybe you think that about Scully. Do you think that? Like, do you think Scully's the standout or Mulder is the...
I definitely lean towards Scully. Everything minus the Christianity, I'm with Scully.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, I mean, the X-Files has done every conceivable angle on aliens and alien conspiracies.
They forget
and
half
UFOs.
The time which one they did, right. Which is why that Chris Carter universe makes no sense.
But one of my favorites in terms of the, like, debunking concepts was the, was it War of the Cockrophages? Something to that effect? But it's the killer cockroaches that are little robots. One of the theories is about swarms of bugs, maybe not necessarily cockroaches, but like with their shimmery skin catching light.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's
or
enough
bioluminescence,
of them,
sure.
Yeah, they dart around the sky, you know, a little more erratically than like a flock of birds.
Yeah,
do.
But they're not like breaking the sound barrier. You know what I'm saying? At the end of the
day,
they're
still
bugs.
I didn't say it was a perfect theory.
Okay. That's a Mulder in me coming out. Sorry.
Yeah, but so recently the idea of UFOs is gained some traction in mainstream because there have been a couple comments sort of declassified by the government, and there was an article in the New York Times, and they also introduced footage from fighter jets with eyes on UFOs, and I'll play the audio because it's the legit surprise of an Air Force pilot who, like, those guys are a disciplined class.
Right.
And they're not the type to freak out.
It's not like they're seeing, you know, St. Elmo's Fire, not the movie, the event, and saying like, oh, that must have been something. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like they
yeah.
know the difference between anything they're seeing outside of their realm there.
look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west. Oh, that thing, dude. That's not our LNS, though, is it? It's not.
That is the LNS, dude.
Well, if there's like that thing, it's rotating.
So I've got a couple paragraphs from the New York Times article that I want to read just to get up to speed in terms of what the government is willing to acknowledge in print, at least. This is the article written by Helen Cooper, Ralph Blumenthal, and Leslie Keene. In the $600 billion annual Defense Department budgets, the $22 million spent on the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program was almost impossible to find, which was how the Pentagon wanted it. For years, the government investigated reports of unidentified flying objects, according to the Defense Department officials, interviews with program participants, and records obtained by the New York Times. It was run by military intelligence official Luis Elizondo on the fifth floor of the Pentagon C-ring, deep within the building's maze. Officials within the program have also studied videos of encounters between unknown objects and American military spacecraft, including one released in August of a whitish oval object about the size of a commercial plane, chased by two Navy FA-18F fighter jets from aircraft carrier Nimitz off the coast of San Diego in 2004, and a more recent encounter between a Navy FA-18 Super Hornet and an unknown object. UFOs have been repeatedly investigated over the decades in the United States, including by the American military. In 1947, the Air Force began a series of studies that investigated more than 12,000 claimed UFO sightings before it was officially ended in 1969. The project, which included a study codenamed Project Blue Book, started in 1952, concluded that most sightings involved stars, clouds, conventional aircraft, or spy planes, although 701 remain unexplained. Contracts obtained by the Times show a congressional appropriation of just under $22 million beginning in late 2008 through 2011. The money was used for management of the program, research, and assessments of the threat posed by the objects. The funding went to Mr. Bigelow's company, Bigelow Aerospace, which hired subcontractors and solicited research for the program. Under Mr. Bigelow's direction, the company modified buildings in Las Vegas for the storage of metal alloys and other materials that Mr. Elizondo and program contractors said had been recovered from unidentified aerial phenomena. Researchers also studied people who said they had experienced physical effects from encounters with the objects and examined them for physiological changes. In addition, researchers spoke to military service members who had reported sightings of strange aircraft. By 2009, Mr. Reed decided that the program had made such extraordinary discoveries that he argued for heightened security to protect it. Quote, "Much progress has been made with identification of several highly sensitive, unconventional aerospace-related findings," Mr. Reed said in a letter to William Lynn III, a deputy defense secretary at the time, requesting that it be designated a, quote, restricted special access program, limited to a few listed officials. Mr. Elizondo has now joined Mr. Puthoff and another former Defense Department official, Christopher K. Mellon, who was a deputy assistant secretary of defense for intelligence in a new commercial venture called To the Stars, Academy of Art and Science. That's where Tom DeLonge comes in.
Yes.
Fella from Blink-182.
He maybe wasn't so wrong all this time.
Up front now, the former Pentagon military official who ran the covert government program up until this last November, Luis Elizondo. Luis, thank you so much for your time tonight. I mean, first, tell us what the purpose of the program was and why it was so secretive.
Sure. The purpose of the program, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, was really designed to do just that. From a national security perspective, identify those things that we see, whether we see them electro-optically, we see them with radar, we see them as eyewitness reports, through a myriad of different ways and avenues that we receive the information, and try to ascertain and determine if that information is a potential threat to national security, in a nutshell.
So what did you find?
Well, we found a lot. I think it's probably been a little bit mischaracterized in some of the social media you see and what people put out, because a lot of times when we don't have a lot of information, we tend to fill in those gaps with what we think is logical. And there's still, by the way, a lot we really don't know. I think what's important is that we have identified some very, very interesting anomalous type of aircraft. Let's call them aircraft. Things that don't have any obvious flight surfaces, any obvious forms of propulsion, and maneuvering in ways that include extreme maneuverability beyond, I would submit, the healthy G-forces of a human or anything biological. Hypersonic velocities, low observability, positive lift, again, seemingly in defying the laws of aerodynamics. So people are talking...
So do you think, but do you believe, when you get that Navy pilot saying what he said, do you think that that was, a UFO? To obviously, I don't have any other word to use, or something else?
Sure, that's a great question. Keeping in mind, it's not just the pilot's testimony on an observation. Sure, when someone comes to you who's in charge of a multi-million dollar weapon platform, who maintains a top secret security clearance, who is paid and trusted by this country to go fight wars and to fly over cities with live munitions, and by the way, they're trained observers with millions of dollars invested in their training,
yep.
I would submit to you it's pretty compelling. But on top of that, it's not just the eyewitness testimony. It is actual electro-optical data and radar returns. It's also people like radar operators and air traffic controllers. So I think the discussion should be maybe a little bit broader than that. I think people are focusing just on two videos coming from a set of F-18s when really it's a lot more than that.
I watched a lot of Tom DeLonge's interview with Joe Rogan.
And how did that go?
Joe
Rogan is an interesting interviewer.
He is.
Because
he was more polite in person than he was after the fact.
Yeah, he's very polite in person, and he allows people to, I think, say really crazy shit. Like his demeanor, something about it, is like really great for interviewing.
So a word that comes up a ton out of his mouth specifically is fascinating, and that is his overall demeanor. Like he's had legit Neil deGrasse Tyson mm-hmm. types and, paleontologists and all sorts of different scientists and people in the sciences. And he, in the moment treats them with all the same due respect. And so Tom DeLonge, he asks questions that we would ask. And then after the fact, he kind of said that he kind of, between being cagey about what he would and wouldn't say on the show
mm-hmm.
and the things that he did discuss, being pretty radical. Like, he kind of called Tom DeLonge a little, like, paranoid and,
yeah.
A little obsessive. That said, like, Tom DeLonge had some pretty wacky thoughts about, like, what the original Roswell crash was.
Dude, you think it had to do with aliens?
Oh, I absolutely think it. Well, both, because what I believe crashed at Roswell was I believe it was German from Argentina, but it had hallmarks and technology based on alien technology. So we put out a story saying it's alien, and then we put out a story saying it's a weather balloon. But the real thing it was, we didn't want anyone to guess, and that's why we put those two things out there. And that's kind of how they do it. I think they did that with the moon. It's like, we went to the moon, and then they put out this meme. We didn't go to the moon, but they didn't want people really going, well, what's on the moon?
So I've watched more than probably a normal person should watch of Ancient Aliens, the TV show on the History Channel.
In all fairness, Jackson drags you into a lot of that stuff.
And you wanted to have Jackson on the show, and I thought, no, because I don't want people to know that he's insane. So no, I'm not going to encourage that behavior. And he even wanted to, he's like, oh, are you, can I be on that show? And I was like, no, Darren doesn't want you on that show.
Oh, shit.
Anyway, I put it off on you to save my marriage. And so Ancient Aliens, when I kind of stopped being like, I can't even entertain this stuff, is when they said like Hitler had been visited by aliens, or that, Hitler was working on this bell-shaped flying object, which is true, he was, but it was supposedly because it was because aliens gave him the technology or something. And then I said, you know what? I can't watch this shit anymore. Like, I can't. But the Hitler and aliens.
I'm in for the
aliens.
Occult, but you introduce Hitler and aliens. Yeah. That's crossing a line.
That's crossing a line. And that's what really, really did it. You know, and Tom DeLonge being into it, it's kind of interesting because, you know, I always say, if I had a lot of money, I would be like a ghost hunter. Mm-hmm. I would be a paranormal investigator. I wouldn't really go searching for UFOs, but Tom DeLonge did. And in 2006, Robbie Williams, you know, he had just had this kind of resurgence in his career in the early 2000s. And in 2006, he decides he's not going to do that anymore. And he goes searching for aliens in Arizona, spends tons of money on this stuff, and then
and meth, and
I'm sure he was smoking crack or something.
Didn't he sort of spun out?
Yeah, there was a lot of problems, and so it kind of all culminated in 2008, and then eventually everyone around Robbie Williams said, "You got to stop this shit," and so he talks about it now, but like he barely talks about it. He'll talk about it like, "Oh yeah, I was fat and paranoid," and that's what he'll say. Oh, but he's not allowed by his handlers, you know, to talk about it.
Maybe for the best. Where Tom DeLonge has invested tons of money and is essentially doing like a publicity tour fundraising for that mm-hmm. Reach for the Stars project. I don't know that they're promising, but they have certainly announced that they are trying to duplicate the kind of technology it takes to have a flying saucer of sorts that can hover and maneuver. And I guess there's also some talk of, I don't know, sort of interdimensional something, but it's all theoretical.
But we know from our Patreon episode that's coming out this month, that's a plug that I just did right there, in the Cloverfield Paradox, that we should not mess with interdimensional kind of things.
Yes, lest we unleash demons.
Yes, it's true.
So one of the documentaries that you suggested I watch that, you know, that I could watch and not think less of you for recommending was Unacknowledged, which is on Netflix. It's directed by Michael Mazzola, and it does the sort of broad look back. They do address a bunch of declassified material. And it does center around, I mean, in the intro, you joked about like a doctor or scientist being a UFO witness. Right. In this case, like we actually are following the retired physician and UFOologist, right, Stephen M. Greer.
I'm going to introduce a man who says there are more things between heaven and hell than any of us have accepted. And I have the witnesses and the documents to prove it. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Stephen Greer.
On May 9th, 2001, 20 military, government, and corporate witnesses held a press conference in Washington, D.C.
And these are folks who have been involved in so-called black budget or covert unacknowledged projects.
They described a decades-long conspiracy to cover up extraterrestrial visitation to Earth.
These unacknowledged special access projects are taking in at least $40 to $80 billion per year.
And the study of extraterrestrial technology in covert military programs.
And they are sitting on technologies that can change the world forever.
This technology would liberate Earth from fossil fuels, environmental devastation, and poverty in a single generation.
I didn't believe in UFOs until London Control called us in the winter of 1962 and asked us, would we chase one?
Their testimony would make history.
I said, well, you're going to tell the public about it. And he says, no, we don't tell the public about this. It would panic the public.
This was the most watched event in the history of the National Press Club.
I had a hard time getting through the first 5 minutes on account of the opening credits.
I feel like I've seen literally that song used same way before.
Yeah, it's Louis Armstrong's take on What a Wonderful World. But my issue is with the video that's played over this.
Right.
The documentary like doesn't give you a moment before it jumps into zeitgeist territory, mm-hmm. like deep conspiracy theory, overlapping with like everything from 9/11 footage to in the opening credits, we kind of get the aerial footage of a guy blowing his head off with a shotgun. Mm-hmm. Like, there's creepy, fucked up, unrelated shit.
I think it's trying to show like the hostility of Earth people, and the main, I think, overwhelming point is that we don't know that the UFOs are hostile, but we know that we are. And I think that's the idea.
Yeah.
I felt this really hammered home.
Yeah, in a pretty sophomoric, amateur way, especially joined with the music that, like, again, it's something we've seen before.
Like, be serious.
Right, but at the same time, like, if you're making this documentary, wouldn't you want to, like, keep the crazy at bay?
No, because they don't think it's crazy.
But
they even
incorporate 9/11 conspiracies in this thing, and it kind of, I don't know, it's pretty classless.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's how all these documentaries are. You don't expect, it's out of all the UFO documentaries, which I haven't seen them all on Netflix, but I've watched a great deal.
This one has probably got
the best production value.
Yeah, that I felt.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, compared to those, you know. You're comparing, you know.
Of the fringe, it's relatively sane.
Exactly, exactly. There you go, Darren.
Okay, so a couple of the thoughts I had while watching it. The sort of broad look at what types of UFOs have been witnessed. Mm-hmm. I like that as a cross-section sort of in terms of like the comparison between the... we've got like probe-shaped UFOs that have been seen.
Yeah, like egg-shaped.
Yeah, and then we've got your traditional flying saucers. There's the one on the fighter pilot footage that looks like a traditional UFO that like could very well fit into the day the Earth stood still, like mm-hmm. that kind of style. And I thought like, hey, the Air Force has any number of different types of planes and jets and bombers and even drones and satellite vehicles. So why wouldn't the aliens have different types of ships, whether they're doing observation? There's mention of a UFO being seen over Stonehenge. That's good sightseeing.
Yes.
I think the documentary came out just before the admission that there was recovered UFO alloys mm-hmm. that they now hold in that weird basin,
which is awesome.
Nevada.
It's awesome. Come on. That shit's crazy cool. Like, you can think these people are crazy all you want, but the fact that there really is tangible evidence and there is actual tangible documentation now that says something was there and all of this was tried to be covered up. Come on. Like, you can't Scully your way out of this one.
Well, I was a little thrown because like the next sentence that follows the alloy mention is that it's presumably that of a UFO. Did they get shot down? Where do they leak these out? Are they dropping? Is it a shoddy spaceship?
It's from the crash, the recovery.
Yeah, but they don't specify which crash. They don't say necessarily that it was Roswell. They've kind of like completely disregarded Roswell, the government. Yes. Like they're not associating anything, any evidence that we have now with that original crash.
That's true. But we do have people who were involved in what, like that Area 51 kind of idea, which we know is not exactly, you know, true. It's kind of like a false kind of event, this Area 51. But we have people who said, like, I recovered bodies or I recovered this. They're saying it. They were on the base.
Yeah.
Why are we disbelieving them?
We actually did recoveries of crashed saucers. There were bodies that were involved with some of these crashes. Also, some were alive.
Going into it skeptically, like, you want more than a firsthand account, especially... I mean, consider if we're judging UFO sightings by the same standards that we would, like, in a court trial. Mm-hmm. Witness testimony is pretty shoddy. It's pretty famously flawed.
That's true. True
and
statement.
These are extreme scenarios that could be influenced by any number of different factors. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's reasonable to be skeptical of even those supposed firsthand accounts.
My question then to you would be this. Do you think that there are other things like people out in the universe?
Oh, as skeptical as I am, I think there's something from somewhere else that's visiting. But yeah, I don't know. I think whatever's happening is imperfect. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's... I get the argument that whatever is visiting us from presumably light years away, mm-hmm. from a inhabitable planet that we don't even have eyes on at the moment, that they would have crazy advanced technology just to show up.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
at the same time, NASA, literally run by rocket scientists, the best minds we have, they still fuck up launches. Like, they still have all kinds of disasters in the process of space exploration and scientific discoveries. So an alien showing up to a foreign planet within a foreign atmosphere, they might still be sort of figuring out just how to engage.
Sure,
they might
sure.
not have a perfect game plan as of yet. And, okay, so one of my favorite sort of analogies in terms of the disparity between mankind and whatever might be out there in terms of extraterrestrial life was something that Neil deGrasse Tyson had said. He talked about us and chimps, mm-hmm. that we are, whatever, 98.9% DNA matched to chimps. So that leaves your 1 point whatever different. 1% difference between our DNA and chimps, and that 1% difference is the difference between Mozart. That difference is the difference between being able to leave the atmosphere in a spacecraft that we've designed. We are that much more capable than chimps, and it's only down to that 1% difference in DNA. Conceive of an alien species that evolved on a different planet in a different atmosphere. What if they're 5% different?
Mm-hmm.
What if they're 10% different?
Right.
What if when we try and communicate to them, all they hear is moo? And so that gives me pause.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that we haven't been summarily dismissed or wiped out by this species, whatever it might be, I think it bodes well. I think they're probably not here for harm's sake.
Right.
In the documentary, Unacknowledged, they talk about the potential catalyst that might have been the first nuclear tests. And the idea, this demonstration of this mass release of power that is a nuclear bomb, maybe putting us on the map in mm-hmm. terms of aliens paying attention.
Like, look what they figured out finally.
Right. Or also that, like, these chimps figured out nuclear damage, and that's a potential threat. I kind of thought of it in terms of, like, if there was an island, you know, in the middle of a giant lake that had chimps and we saw that they developed weapons, we would keep an eye if they developed boats.
That's true.
You know, if they want to bring their bad attitudes and their weapons in our direction, like, we would keep tabs.
So there are some really cool, interesting things that are based in factual information.
Declassified documents.
Right.
And factual Hoover was,
documents. Yeah. However, there are some really zany, I might say the word zany theories. My favorite, and you pointed it out as well, Marilyn Monroe, that she was going to, she knew about aliens and then she was going to tell people about aliens.
Yeah.
And that's why she got killed.
That in the process of sleeping with both JFK and Robert Kennedy,
yeah.
one of them perhaps, well, they speculate as to maybe she saw a document on a desk,
right.
or perhaps one of those two was eager to impress her. It's not enough that they were president and going to be president.
Right.
But they're like, get a load of this. There's aliens.
And that she goes, oh, yes, that's probably true as well. Like, the whole thing makes no sense.
Yeah. And that she might have threatened to hold some sort of press conference or write a tell-all book about it, that, like, it's not enough that you're having a secret affair with the president
yeah,
and his
no.
brother.
It just seemed so very, very dumb. And then the fact that Burl Ives is the one who, like,
oh,
is
yeah.
giving this information. Like,
33-degree like, Mason.
Yeah, Burl Ives, the guy who is Frosty the Snowman, right? He sings the Frosty the Snowman song. And no. Why is this crazy stuff in there? Why can't we have this? And this goes back to the intro. Why can't we have, like, really respectable people not being zany, just telling the facts as they exist? Why we gotta make it more?
Yeah. if I was Stephen M. Greer, having like essentially provided the pillar on which this documentary is built, and then seeing all these extra components mm-hmm. of like, you know, Marilyn Manson, Marilyn Monroe's murder / suicide, and a lot of the overlapping conspiracy visuals with 9/11 and like all this shit, like it's just, it's periphery. You're just mucking up what, you know, we talked about it. Like there are documents, there's acknowledgments from the government. On the FBI website, there's J. Edgar Hoover signing off on like essentially inner office memos that talk about sightings and the legitimacy of it.
And like, going to explore those things.
We better prepare. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's tons of legitimate
why the
evidence.
Shenanigans.
Yeah. So the documentary kind of loses out there. I think it gets really interesting in terms of the international output. And they make a big to-do about declassified French material. And I went to the website and I looked it up, and it's not as groundbreaking as they lead you to believe in the right. documentary. It's essentially it's two parts. It's one is a collection of UFO sightings, and they just kind of amass these things for the public to have a look at. And the other part is a lot of like what if preparation
sure.
and sort of the grounds on which we would try and communicate with these, you know, outsiders. Side note, did you happen to see the movie Arrival?
Yes. And I loved it.
It's one of the greatest pieces of science fiction that's been made into a film in the last like long, long time. And that it was all about communication.
Yes.
Was fascinating.
I love it.
Yeah. I really dug that. And so, I mean, that stuff interests me. The idea that there should be people who study everything from like languages to cryptography who should be at the ready in terms of, you know, having to decode a language we've never seen before.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. Absolutely. I think what's really funny is I've been looking into ASL stuff with ASL, and ASL is a nonlinear language.
Sorry. I don't actually know
American
what ASL.
Sign language.
Ah, okay.
And so it works in a kind of nonlinear way. And it's like, that's the kind of people we need to study communication, because yep. it's not that it's going to be one word right after another
sure.
kind of idea. Interesting side note, it's narrated by Gus from Breaking Bad, Giancarlo Esposito, and I was like, that's interesting and strange.
Yeah, I feel like he probably saw this documentary and he's like, what is this extra shit in
yeah.
there?
He's like, my script did not have all this in
no,
it.
No, they did not tell me what visuals would be overlapping at times.
On a weird other documentary, don't watch it. It's not worth watching unless you're really, really into this stuff. I watched the Stan Romanek documentary. He is the guy who created the Boo video. I don't know if you've ever heard of or seen Boo, but it's been disproven, obviously, because it's ridiculous. And it's essentially this guy has a camera on a tripod, and he's like, there he is again. And you look out his window, and there's like a little mask of an alien who like peeks his head in the window and like goes down, and the guy's freaking out on video. And a lot of alien want to believers like really like hung on to this video. And this man has so many experiences that he's documented through his years. And now we know he's in trouble for some very less than good stuff.
You could say it is child pornography.
Yeah, child pornography.
He has some wacky ideas, you were saying, in terms of like alien human hybrids.
Yes, and these phone calls that he gets where they call him literally Starseed. I mean, in like the funniness of it, it's worth a watch because it's funny, but at the same time, in retrospect, knowing now that he, you know, had all this child pornography on his computer, it's like not really funny to watch. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
it's two things at once.
Ugh. Yeah, no. Okay. I'm happy not to go into that guy.
So let's move on.
Some of the earliest UFO sightings in modern times came from jet pilots, as it turns out. I remember looking this up in high school when Foo Fighters first announced that Dave Grohl was starting up another band, and that first album was Hot Fire.
Mm-hmm,
and I all sorts of curious why the name Foo Fighters, what that meant. And at the time, it being a reference to accounts from fighter pilots seeing balls of fire or glowing orbs that were tailing them not menacing, but just like sort of observing at the same pace as these fighter jets. And that those stories go back to World War II is fascinating. And, you know, it's kind of gone through waves of different disclosures and sort of revelations. But this is from Time Magazine, January 5th, 1945. This is the first paragraph of that article. If it was not a hoax or an optical illusion, it was certainly the most puzzling secret weapon the Allied fighters have yet encountered. Last week, U.S. night fighter pilots based in France told a strange story of balls of fire, which for more than a month had been following their planes at night over Germany. No one seemed to know what, if anything, the fires were supposed to accomplish. Pilots, guessing that it was a new psychological weapon, named it the Foo Fighter. 1945. So this is pre-Roswell, even. Now, this section is taken from HowStuffWorks.com, an article there. A little-remembered cartoon character named Smokey Stover used to declare, "Where there's foo, there's fire." So when enigmatic aerial phenomenon kept pace with airplanes and ships in both the European and Pacific theaters during World War II, someone called them Foo Fighters. The name stuck. Nobody knew for sure what the Foo Fighters were, but it was usually assumed that the other side, either the Allies or the Axis powers, had developed a secret weapon. After the war's conclusion, it soon became clear that this was not the explanation. Official censorship kept reports of these phenomena out of the newspapers until December 1944. All during the war, however, similar objects were sighted by both military and civilian observers in the United States. Now, going back to the idea of different, like, spacecrafts,
mm-hmm.
in 1945, these being, I mean, I guess if you really dig deep, there are all sorts of even Egyptian accounts or Mayan accounts of, like, men coming from the sky, fire in the sky, even. But in this case, 1945, I wondered if, like, if this is their first introduction to our atmosphere, like we know that everything comes through our atmosphere, essentially catches fire just on account of the friction. So like maybe they hadn't perfected the, you know, exterior shell or whatever it was of the spacecraft.
They just keep burning up when everyone comes here. But there's also a phenomenon which the idea of it really took hold in sailors was the idea of St. Elmo's fire, which is flashing glowing light in the sky.
Which is, I'm familiar with like ball lightning.
Yeah, so it's similar. It's this like bioluminescent kind of looking, like where it's very iridescent looking. It's plasma created from a coronal discharge from a sharp or pointed object in a strong electric field. So you have to have something metal in an electric field, which attracts the lightning and gives you this kind of, what is that? Northern Lights kind of looking thing.
Okay. Okay, so far more broad than, say, like a concentrated, like ball lightning.
It'll look like look small or it can be big across the sky. It depends on what's caught it, what's up there that caught its electric charge.
Right. So, yeah, I could imagine like debris in a heavy wind. I mean, here in New York, we see on like corners the little tornadoes that happen and catch like plastic bags. But like if it's any sort of metallic debris might pop into the air and then draw.
So any kind of even metal that's up there. And so sailors would sail by that and it was a sign of good luck.
Oh.
And so it's called St. Elmo's Fire because Erasmus is the saint of sailors. And so this was like, okay. Oh, there he is. But you can
Erasmus,
actually.
Erasmus, everybody knows his nickname being Elmo.
It is Elmo. that's so when you think about that little character on TV, Elmo, his full name is Erasmus. Erasmus P. Reddington. I don't know what his name is. but what's kind of cool is you can go online, you can look at YouTube of different planes of commercial flights in the middle of a St. Elmo's fire kind of phenomenon. And it's so cool. And of course, early people would think that this was something alien.
Even some modern people.
Absolutely. If I saw some St. Elmo's fire on my wing, I would freak the fuck out.
All right. So from truly fascinating subject matter, let's dive into one of the strangest goddamn movies we will ever cover on this podcast. And that's saying a lot.
Like, we've covered some strange things.
Yeah.
And this is
not a lot of Christopher
awful.
Walken movies. So this is kind of, this is upping the ante.
Like, I hate you a little for this.
All
Okay, so before we dive into this movie, it should be known that Lewis Whitley Strieber wrote some pretty good horror novels, of which The Wolfen and The Hunger were both made into movies that are pretty highly regarded. I've only seen The Hunger. I haven't seen Wolfen.
Me neither. I've obviously seen The Hunger.
You're a big fan of
The Hunger. Huge fan of it.
But so his career took a turn when he started writing his autobiographic series, starting with Communion and then Transformation. Both of those kind of make their way into this film. And then Breakthrough, the next step, is the sort of last of the trilogy. The more I read, he kind of feels like L. Ron Hubbard to me in terms of someone who's capitalizing on the, like, leg up in terms of, like, science fiction.
It's science fiction writing, and then someone's like, you could say this is true, and but that was literally him saying it to himself. No one actually ever said that to him. And he's like, I could say this is true, and then he did, and it's not.
Yeah, some of his later books seem like direct ripoffs of premises and X-Files episodes.
It's
like the book, the 2006 book, The Grays in particular. But okay, so not to hark on that. From the writer-director who brought us Pterodactyl Women from Beverly Hills, Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, which was recently featured on How Did This Get Made? I recommend people watch that. The next in the series, The Marsupials, The Howling 3.
Right.
Ugh. So
we should do a Howling episode.
Doing all of them?
Yeah.
All right. We haven't really done werewolves very well.
No, we never talk about werewolves.
We don't. I like a good werewolf story. Good werewolf stories are hard to come by, but yeah, I'm down for that. I'm talking about Philip Mora, the director, who is prolific. It's not much good in there in terms of his output. It's weird to think that Communion might be of his better films, although on IMDb they don't presume that it's one of his more popular films.
It's The Howling too.
Yeah, I guess.
Probably.
But like, who actually saw The Howling 2 at the time? It's not,
I don't know.
It's not good. But okay, so written, both the book and the screenplay was written by Whitley Strieber, and it does join material from the first two books in his Alien autobiography. You know what? In all fairness, he doesn't call them aliens. He doesn't presume where they are from.
No. And he gets annoyed at the fact that in this movie, it is very much portrayed as aliens from outer space.
Yeah.
He doesn't like that.
Even if I was batshit crazy or just, you know, capitalizing on whatever opportunities, I would still look at this and find it wildly disrespectful. Starring Christopher Walken.
That's where the disrespect
Strieber
comes in. right there with Christopher Walken.
Across from him, playing his wife, is Lindsay Krause, who was in another Alien movie, the Charlie Sheen Arrival.
I have never seen that.
It's not good.
Huh.
No, I wouldn't recommend that one. And then Frances Sternhagen plays the therapist. She's kind of a third act character.
I'm cooking. I'm on a roll. What's the matter with you? Boom!
Whitley Strieber goes with his family and some friends to his holiday home in the forest. They experience some weird occurrences. Are they UFO activity? Whitley is abducted and then faces a horrible dilemma. Was I abducted or am I going mad? He sees a psychiatrist who tries to use hypnotic regression to discover the truth.
Not a lot of movie synopsises have questions in them.
Yeah. And you know what? None of these questions are ever answered, and you don't even care the answer to them.
No, this movie just kind of wears you out.
What's funny about this is, you know, we'll do it later when we eventually do our Creepy Kids episode, mm-hmm. when that actually will come out. But so much of horror is based on gaslighting, usually gaslighting a woman character who's like, I know what's up. And then her husband's like, maybe do you? I don't think so.
It's like, is it that? Or are you just on your period?
This is actually Christopher Walken gaslighting himself.
That's a good way to put it.
It's so bizarre.
Do you drink?
Sure, but that's not it.
Drugs? When I was a kid, you know, the usual thing, but that's... I'm way too old for that.
So what scared them? What happened?
I'm talking about it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light.
The opening credits are scored. It's the only part of the movie, right? It's the theme to...
Yeah, and then they just cut it up, much like I do with interstitials on our episodes. And make this one song last the entire movie.
So Eric Clapton contributed like four slow notes of guitar for an intro
and
outro.
Which we can expect from that, because there's an Yngwie Malmsteen quote, and I don't know the exact quote, but I remember reading it and laughing my ass off. Yngwie Malmsteen, you know, they're talking about Eric Clapton, and he says, like, I don't know why Eric Clapton's so famous. He only just played the same three notes for his entire career. And, like, here it is in this movie being the theme to Communion.
Yeah. It
It's terrible sounding. It sounds awful. And it's 1989. It is not, like, 1970.
Yeah, but...
This is pure garbage.
The 80s really... It was a slow bleed between 89... And, like, I'm going to say, like, 92, we finally got over some of the staples from 80s films.
It's bad.
But this is entrenched in 80s aesthetics. Everything from, like, the color palettes, there's a lot of beige. The aliens are not grays. They are pink.
Yes.
And or beige.
Or but, that bluey, muddy color.
Yeah. Well, we could dive into that for the moment. So we've got, like, two different classes of aliens – one of which seemed to be more the foot soldiers. Those are the little guys. They reminded me of Phantasm, the guys who were sort of crushed to the ground.
Except
on
for
account
I love
high
those
gravity.
Guys in Phantasm, and I did not love this.
No, these guys have generally fixed faces. I think they get a little bit of motion in the eyes.
Very
the
rare.
Eyebrows.
Only certain ones are given appliances that actually move. One of them has a kissy face.
There's
face.
One with the puckered lips.
He's probably the main anal prober. And then everyone else just looks kind of grumpy. They're the probed. Who knows?
And
they have to clean the probe.
Gross. The traditional big eyes, skinny body aliens they barely move at all. Like we get their arms. They're kind of, they look like the Gumby figures that we might have played with as kids.
So remember when I was telling you about that video Boo, the Stan Romanek Boo video?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that, where when Christopher Walken first sees the pinky big-eyed aliens, it like peeks around the door, and it's literally just someone holding the mask doll and then like putting it back.
But that little bit of a glimpse, I thought that was as good as any of the scares ever got in this movie.
I thought that was the start of me being like, this movie's extra terrible. Like I thought it, starting off with Eric Clapton, I was like, this sucks because the way to my heart is not through Eric Clapton. And so already I was turned off, and then I see this little guy peek around and I'm like, God damn it.
Yeah, the pairings in this. Okay, so let's talk about Christopher Walken. Like William Shatner before him, he is so committed to just being himself. You kind of just take it as authentic. Like you stop questioning it. You're just kind of like, he's a really fucking strange, peculiar guy. And here we spend so much time with him when he is alone that, like, we see all the really awkward, like, everybody thinks, like, oh, thank God no one was around to see that. Like,
right.
When we're just being weirdos on our own, whether we're talking to ourselves or doing a dance or whatever. But here, Christopher Walken is playing Whitley Strieber, so he is doing a lot of writing, and that involves...
Talking to a camera.
He's always VHS recorded. This is the early days of VHS, so maybe they were kind of playing up on, like... I don't know. He's savvy. He's tech savvy. I don't know what they were going for.
I don't understand why he would be doing that.
There were wolves in the closet, wolves in the basement, wolves all over the place. They work in advertising. They sell junk food and beer. They eat gigantic hamburgers, and they drink cold beers with the baseball games on the TV and the bags of the potato chips that are big enough to feed a horse.
Yeah.
he's always got a pad with him. So, like, any ideas he could write down, he doesn't need to videotape everything. It doesn't make any sense. Okay, anyway. But he is so peculiar in his acting choices that more often than not, he always feels like he's in a different scene than everybody else in the scene with him.
Absolutely. So even when he's interacting with that doll in the very first alien sighting, he's so calm about it. It's like he doesn't even know he just saw this. Like nothing makes sense. And so they go, they live in this thing. Let's get into this thing, this garbage. They're in New York and then they're going to go for the weekend upstate somewhere, let's say. So he's got this other couple of friends, him and his wife and his kid, and then these two friends that are also a couple. None of these people like each other.
No.
Why are they in a car together going upstate?
But I thought, like, maybe that other guy's also a novelist and they have that in common.
I'm just
But we
very
get
confused.
No one's backstory.
No.
The story is disinterested.
They all dislike each other a great deal, except for Christopher Walken and his wife laugh all the time at each other.
Yeah. You do get the feeling that most of their playing around is ad-libbed.
Yes.
Like, none of that felt scripted at all. Christopher Walken is just kind of being a weirdo. I don't know much about Christopher Walken. I kind of assume he's part alien, just in terms of, like, instincts and choices.
There's also this little kid who's a terrible actor. I hate him. And he's full of sass. And
he's got some of the, like, best scripted lines. They're not delivered all that well.
Nope, terrible.
But I don't know. I like little moments, like when they're, as a family, walking down the street, and the kid's just being a weirdo, making faces and avoiding stepping on cracks and stuff like that. Like, I don't know. I like the little kid.
Oh, I didn't. There was too much cheek, and I don't tolerate that.
So once they're all upstate, both the husband and wife and Christopher Walken's family, there is a light in the sky, and it's like the floodlights. Incidentally, this remote cabin also has the highest tech security system.
I made a note because I wrote early on he has to push a bunch of buttons as well, and I thought to myself, how many buttons do these people push a day? I push like zero buttons in my daily life, but they have to do all these codes and shit, because that also starts with this weird fire alarm thing.
Yeah.
Also, that doesn't make any sense. And then the fire department's like really mad at him for burning whatever the shit he was cooking.
We see him put like a duck in the oven, and then he goes off to write, and he clearly forgets that he was preparing dinner. And then the smoke alarm sets off. It's also the most gentle smoke alarm anyone's ever heard.
Mine is like pure panic, where I have to run on top of a chair and almost fall down.
Yeah, it's why people stab at them with broomsticks and
break them. I
stab
sometimes with a knife, yeah.
Because sometimes that's the easier way to stop that noise from happening. It's terrifying. But in this case, yeah, the fire department seemingly lives next door and visit often because they're on first-name basis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they're going to fine him. And then I thought to myself, is that true? Will they fine you?
For having your smoke detector go off. I've never heard that. Maybe it's like three strikes and you're out.
That's
like
they've terrible.
Visited so often. Well, I don't know. At this point, like, he's a threat to himself and his family. A fine is the least of his worries.
That's true. True statement. Anyway, so they push all these buttons. Anyway, this is big light. We'll go back to that. You know why none of this makes any sequitur sense? Because this movie doesn't make sequitur sense.
No, it doesn't bother to.
So we're doing this segment as if we wrote this movie.
You people, you're in. I'm telling you, you're in for one big surprise. One very big surprise.
So everybody does experience the light.
Yes.
Although his wife is the only person who doesn't really notice at all.
Which would be me. I can sleep through anything.
Yeah.
Sometimes they film right outside my house and it's like daylight. They'll film like daylight scenes out there at night. I sleep right through that.
So they've already introduced the idea that there are floodlights as part of the security system. So one might presume that that's the light from outside.
Sure.
But I think Walken steps outside, just doesn't really have a handle on what the light is. But the couple that are visiting with them are completely freaked out. The little kid is also – is that the moment where the little kid's kind of like dragged out of bed a little bit?
Yes.
Okay, so the kid has good reason to be terrified. The wife is completely unaware.
Right.
The next morning, the guest couple want to go home.
Fair.
Like they're terrified.
That's the smartest move they made.
Yeah, I think it's I mean, that's the last we see of them, right?
I don't know why he sits down with them.
I think maybe, I don't know. It comes up in Fire in the Sky in terms of like having more witnesses, lending more legitimacy, but but so that guy does come back in the diner where Christopher Walken relays more of his experience, but that's, yeah, that's needless. But at that point, like, now Christopher Walken has seemingly had his third eye opened, and now he's having these experiences or flashbacks to the experiences.
And his wife is really mad at him for being scared.
I think the only authentic thing in this movie is how angry his wife gets at him.
She's so mad at him, and not about like making up a story or anything, but for being scared, essentially, is what her anger stems from.
Yeah.
As we go on, they have another experience. They go back out to the cabin, and here's a lesson for gun safety.
Holy shit.
Do not fire your gun in your house at aliens. Don't do it. Do not do it, because you might shoot towards your wife.
That's got to spread.
Yeah, no, she gets away unharmed by this.
First, he kills the vase that, as he saw it, was being held up by one of the short, munchkin-looking guys, perhaps with the pouty lips.
Right.
And then it turns out, no, he just shot a vase. And then his wife enters the room, and he has that moment where, like, it's like locking your keys in the car, where your physical body is ahead of your thought process. And so he pulls the trigger and then kind of like yanks back at the last second to sort of not shoot her in the face.
Right.
But just barely missing her. And then she spends the next, you know, couple hours, if not days, kind of in shock that she was almost gunned down in her own home.
She's
by her
also
husband.
Angry at him. Angrier at him. And in that kind of experience, then we get the next abduction or whatever, and we get the rectal probing.
Yep.
Which my note said, LOL, rectal probe. Well, that shit's funny.
I'm trying to remember the order of things, because he also gets convinced by his doctor to see a therapist,
right.
And there's some back and forth in terms of like what might be going on. They test him for a type of epilepsy that might have led to hallucinations.
And there's also a scene where they're going back and forth, and he's like, I'm not going to go back to that doctor. And his wife like whips her chancleta off, and she is going to fucking beat him. And Christopher Walken doesn't have enough sense to know, like, when you see that shoe come off, you're going to fucking get it. And then he goes, he literally says, crazy women.
He does.
You don't say that to a woman with a chancleta in their hand. Can you imagine?
It wasn't a Spanish slipper. It was like a short heel.
It had the same. It was gonna do the same thing. Same damage.
So understandably jarred after being nearly killed by her husband in whatever trance state he was blasting up the living room. She sends him to the therapist. At which point, like, he relays to her what we've seen some of in terms of their little guys. There was a bright light in the sky, and then he was on the ship. There were little guys. They touched him with a little, you know, prod thing behind the ear. His wife thought that looked like a spider bite. And oh, there was the anal probing. And that, like, he buries the lead, pun intended, and just casually brings that up last.
Yeah, like, by the way, this happened. Also, the scene is very
diving into the hypnosis moment where he gets the full flashback.
I'm just have so much anal probing on my mind.
Because he relays the story to the therapist, and then he gets a little upset. Maybe the, you know, reminiscing about the forced anal probing sets him off. And then, like, he leaves the place with the wife and therapist behind, and then that's when the wife is angry that he's not taking it seriously and throws her shoe. And so when he does go back and does go under hypnosis, also the hypnotic regression therapy is how the lady refers to it. And I think that's the same sort of pseudoscience that Fox Mulder goes under to remember his sister's abduction.
Right. So there's all this actual like work done about this regression hypnotherapy. It is mostly bullshit.
It's hokum.
And there's a reason we don't do it anymore or very much, because it's very unreliable.
Right. My takeaway was that it's emotionally corrective in terms of like thinking back to experiences or traumatizing events that you're kind of relating to, you know, what you sort of reframed as an experience rather than the truth of the matter. And so it's not an realistic or accurate account of something that happened to you.
Yeah.
And so when he does go under, then we get the full-on visual of the whole scientific exploration of his body. There's some touching of probes. And then, like, he's very calm and, I'm going to say, generous to this observation where we always – I think having seen Fire in the Sky first, like – that moment is body horror.
Right.
When they're conducting experiments, it's jarring for that reason. But here, Christopher Walken is completely naked.
Yeah.
In a room with a couple aliens, a couple different types of aliens.
And he's kind
of
like, okay.
Right. He kind of like shuffles to the edge of the table and kind of offers up his bum. And like, I mean, it begs the question, why ever anal probing at all? Why is that a thing associated with aliens?
So I went down the butthole rabbit hole here and said, okay, listen, when was the first time we ever got this idea of probing? Because someone probably started this. And there's actually an article that's kind of worth a little read on futurism, which is
futurism.
Called Why Didn't Ancient Aliens Probe Human Anuses? By Robert Lamb, and it talks about how we have all this history of aliens or other beings coming throughout all sorts of history, all sorts of cultures.
Yes.
And
I love
never
Stargate.
Really, I love Stargate too. Never really until the 20th century do we get anal probing.
Mm.
It is a 20th century ideal. So where did it start? And again, I'm going down this rabbit hole of sorts. Anal probing in the 20th century happens to mostly straight white men who are being abducted. Your women don't really get this. It is a 20th century alien phenomenon. The first probing they think can date back to the first probing story. They think can date back to this guy named Barney Hill in 1964.
Of course, it's to Barney.
Barney Hill in 1964, and he is an abduction person. He is an abductee. He goes through some regression therapy that they had in the 60s. And from that, he tells a story about the aliens being in black leather jackets. Okay, where does the black leather jackets come from? This is interesting. Maybe he got abducted by a gang and anally probed. I don't know. But it actually comes from a Twilight Zone that aired a month before this regression therapy.
Oh.
The aliens ride on motorcycles and have black leather jackets in this episode. And that happened a month before the therapy. And then they don't do any anal probing in that episode of the Twilight Zone. But in the Outer Limits, in the same month, there was an episode where there's a guy naked and the aliens are around him. And it could kind of seem like they're like kind of into some sort of butt play, but not – I mean, it's the Outer Limits, so it's not like up
graphic.
In there. Yeah, nothing's up in there, right? And so he's just influenced by these two TV shows at the same time and then has this regression therapy, and he's the first guy on record to go forward with this anal probing story. And then it becomes, you know, this big fear because especially in America, American men are so afraid of their buttholes and things going in their buttholes.
Yeah.
Like it's just a bizarre, I think mostly American phenomenon. And it can stem from 1964 is the first time we hear that.
That joke
also
has been made.
Don't
everywhere.
Google anal probing.
I won't.
Just so you know.
I avoided it working up to this. I managed to get by without Googling it this long.
Well, I went down that hole.
But yeah,
and you don't want to.
It is, I don't know. It's so funny to think that like of all the orifices to investigate, like why is the butt the USB plug for the body? That's the B stands for butt. I can't think of a better note to leave the movie Communion. Although,
yeah.
I don't know, I guess it bears some mention that the name Whitley Strieber, one of the things he was kind of bothered by is they didn't really nail the point of Communion and the sort of associations with God. Very late in the movie, they try and add a little bit of the perspective that Whitley Strieber meant to put into it in terms of like the communing with a higher power. references made to the Mask of God, being the Joseph Campbell world mythology concept. Mm-hmm. It feels kind of tacked on. Like at that point, it's kind of an epilogue.
Like, we all went to college. We all read a Joseph Campbell book. Like, fuck you. Like, don't shove that down my throat. I text you after finishing this and I said, I never would have guessed. And I don't care if I'm spoiling because it's a piece of shit movie. But I said, you know, I never would have guessed that this would end with high fives and a Latin music dance party. And yeah, then it totally does.
The last bit, it feels like a compilation of outtakes and B-roll just like working up, because we literally see Christopher Walken hanging out like half naked around like the masks and special effects that make up these aliens, but no one's wearing them.
Right.
He tries on the mask himself. Is he reading a newspaper at one point because there's downtime? Like there's playful music
Nothing
going on.
Makes it's just any sense.
It feels like it wasn't meant to be in the movie, but they just cut together a montage of weird downtime.
It's like at the end of old movies or TV shows where they just have like the dance off at the end and everyone's like, and then there's a party. That's what happened.
Jump in the air, freeze frame. Yeah, no. You also texted that like for some reason Christopher Walken seems to be wearing more and more eyeliner as the movie goes on.
As he gets crazier and crazier. He turns into Duran Duran. But not an attractive Duran Duran.
Christopher Walken, who at one time was a very handsome young man.
I disagree.
And then, no, really?
The way that he looked like Scarlett Johansson, and she is an attractive person.
Well, do you have a circle or a triangular scar anywhere in your body?
No.
Because a lot of us are marked. You know, I want to get back to this participant thing. I didn't want what they did to me. I didn't want a rectal probe, Lori.
So moving on to this much better film, a film that I really, really like, 1993's Fire in the Sky, PG-13 film.
Hmm.
But I think it's pretty fucking scary in parts.
Yeah.
There's some great stuff.
Yeah.
Directed by Robert Lieberman, written by Tracy Torme, who was the creator of Sliders, and he produced I Am Legend, which I enjoy a great deal.
Yeah.
And based on the book by Travis Walton, which was The Walton Experience.
Yeah, based
very
on that,
loosely based.
Based on that book title and what I've read in terms of the circumstances of the original event, I got the feeling that the portrayal in the movie would have felt far more authentic than anything the original Gang of Seven witnessed and the town dealt with after the fact and all that stuff. Like, but yeah, no, the movie is very compelling.
Yes.
And we were talking about it before that for an hour and 50 minute movie with pretty limited plot points, it's actually compelling and it holds on to you and like you feel for these characters.
Right.
And it's kind of, we talked about the gaslighting component that often comes in these mm-hmm. movies. And this is one place where like we're rooting for the guys to be believed.
Right, right.
And not an easy feat, especially in an alien abduction movie.
How does it think? What makes it move? Why does it breathe? Questions anyone would ask about a man if they'd never seen one before. So for 5 days, a man was borrowed.
So this stars Robert Patrick, who we know as Agent Doggett.
Yeah. Among other things. He's the T-1000.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, but he's also Doggett. Doggett and Reyes Forever. It stars also the kid from E.T.
who
never grows up. In all the movies I see him in, he never gets any older. Yeah. He's also in Ouija,
Henry
too.
Thomas. Oh, is he?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Henry Thomas. At this point, he couldn't get away from alien movies.
No. And starring one of my favorites, who I never see in anything, but I love the name, D.B. Sweeney.
Oh, yeah.
D.B. Sweeney used to be synonymous with me and my friends as a way to describe someone who's a douchebag. Not that D.B. Sweeney is,
no,
just that the initials
he
douchebag.
Seems lovely, at least based on The Cutting Edge.
I love The Cutting Edge. He's so good in The Cutting Edge.
Yeah. And Craig Schaefer from Nightbreed.
Mm-hmm.
He's someone whose face I don't like seeing. Like, I think he's really effective in this role because,
like, you know it's going to be a bad movie? You don't like to see his face, or you just don't like to look at his face?
I think in the same way that, like, Joaquin Phoenix, like, like irks me. Yeah, it's just his face.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. It was weird. But also starring Peter Berg, the writer-director. Yeah, this is a great cast.
Yeah.
I didn't remember as well, like, that everybody in this movie is a recognizable face. I think I saw this in the theater when I was a teenager, and then probably once on cable. But I not strong recollections, just kind of... We would do the joke where you stand underneath a streetlight, like a lonely streetlight, and like pretend to be pulled into the air.
We also have James Garner.
Oh, yeah.
And Maverick is mavericking up the place. He is here to solve crimes and root out liars.
There is lore around that man's detective prowess. Okay, so as it relates to our earlier conversations in terms of sightings and things of the like, After watching this movie again and considering the circumstances of a lot of local yokel sightings, the sort of, you know, tradition that gets made fun of on the nightly news, I am slightly more inclined to believe the local yokels because I think they generally spend more time outdoors than your average nerdy types.
People, that's true, probably.
People don't do a lot of, like, you know, these guys are loggers. They're working outdoors. Mm-hmm. They're spending a lot of time probably just looking up because there's nothing better to do. There's cowboys and loggers and maybe some miners. But
right.
There's pretty limited functions, and most of those are outdoors.
Right. That makes sense. And it's vast open space. So it's not like here where I do spend a great deal of time outside in New York. Like, I like to walk around because I see crazy shit just walking around. But I don't look up in the air because there's buildings.
No, and you got to watch your step because you'll step in any number of
There's a dead mouse out there. Did you see it outside in my house?
No.
It's gross. This is 1975 Arizona, this fire in the sky world. It's a crazy place where everyone wears cowboy hats everywhere.
Yeah. I mean,
it's interesting. It struck me as a lot of cowboy hats.
I'll tell you what was period was Robert Patrick's flowing hair.
He had so much hair.
There was one point where, like, it seemed feathered. It looked like he was one of Charlie's Angels. Like,
it was actually very lovely.
He's a very handsome man, especially
he
in
is.
Those early years.
There's parts of me who I also don't think he's handsome, but sometimes he is very handsome.
Like when you think back to like the T-1000?
Or like Doggett. I don't really say like, yeah, because I don't like that spiky kind of haircut he had. But with this flowing mane, it was lovely. And we start out with D.B. Sweeney and we discover, oh, he's a carefree fella. And he's riding his motorcycle
through town
and
the
he's
sidewalk.
Scamming donuts from one girl to give donuts to his other girl who he sneaks in the window like a creeper.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was in plain sight. And that's Robert Patrick is the main character of the movie,
yes.
Right? Like we're kind of riding along with him. And
I mean,
D.B.
Sweeney is
whose house,
technically your main character because none of this would happen without him, I guess.
Right, it's his account.
But yeah, Robert Patrick's the star.
And it's his family that D.B. Sweeney is visiting in the beginning and delivering donuts to and climbing up the window. And Robert Patrick is surprisingly okay with D.B. Sweeney dating and or wanting to marry Robert Patrick's sister.
Yes.
But that window moment was... Yeah, I don't know, whatever. Because D.B. Sweeney's charming. Like, he's a young guy with ambitions. He's got a drawing in his pocket of their motorcycle shop that they're going to start up.
Honestly, if you brought me donuts, you could look through my window at me a little bit. I really like food.
No one listening to the podcast, try that. I have a note here that rotary phones and collect calls. That brings me back to my childhood.
I do not know how to make a collect call. So I actually had to ask Jackson. I was like, do I hit zero? Does zero make a collect call for me? And do I talk to a woman?
I wonder if... Why has it got to be a woman?
I don't know. I feel like an operator is a woman. I don't know because I don't understand these things. I've only seen it in movies.
I guess it changed up. There was the 1-800-COLLECT... That was a new component to the idea of calling. I guess they did it slightly cheaper than the phone company would. But yeah, you would call the operator and say, I'd like to make a collect call. This is the number. They would ask you who's calling. When this became automated, this is how we would get picked up after, like, wrestling matches and shit like that. Like, yeah. We would, in that place where we would give our name, we would say, I'm ready to get picked up. Come get me.
It's so smart. It's so smart.
Yeah, and it's free. They just don't accept
the charges.
As a
little kid, I remember answering the phone, and sometimes my dad's clients, when he was a probation officer, they would call from the jail.
Oh.
Collect, and you'd be like, okay, it's a collect call from the county jail. And I'd be like, no. I remember, like, I was always told, no, don't accept that. It was like a joy in my life being like, no. But I have no clue how to make the call.
You were bad. So Fire in the Sky is the descriptor that they first give the sheriff, and from far off it looks like a forest fire, but
it's
bright red. Yeah, they can tell that it's moving though. And so, you know, fire doesn't move that fast that it looks like it's you know, sort of got a regular pace forward. And so when they, you know, make the mistake, the fateful mistake of going to investigate.
Would you investigate? Or would you run away?
I'd go by instinct. Like, I've seen fires in the woods, like on the sides of roads and that kind of thing. So, like, I feel like I'd be able to distinguish between a legit fire and a hovering craft.
So, you know, it's an alien, though. Are you going to go closer to it?
No.
Or are you going to run away? Right.
No. Do you give in to curiosity at that point?
No, probably not, because I'm terrified of aliens, you know?
Yeah.
I have such a great fear of them. No. Probably I would go the other way.
Yeah. That's probably the right call to make. I think
the red light wouldn't scare me as much. It was the green light from Tommyknockers that as a child terrified me. And that's why I could never have those like Indiglo watches or those plug-in nightlights that made a green light. Uh-uh. I still won't have that in my house.
That's funny. In this case, they do kind of write it off as the road out of this national forest only goes this one direction, so we're going to have to pass it inevitably.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they do see it and they do get closer, like, it is very clearly a hovering spacecraft. It's a flying saucer style. And D.B. Sweeney, the rambunctious D.B. Sweeney, gets out of the car. You never get out of the car.
No.
You never get out of the boat.
No. He plans to charm the aliens with his charm.
And initially, my memory was different. I thought that he got sort of zapped up into the air.
Oh, he gets zapped.
Like, yeah, thrown back really far. And not for nothing, but like his friends fucking panic in a really embarrassing way.
They do, and it's actually totally not cool.
No. Like, Robert Patrick eventually comes to his senses, and he's like, I got to go back and pick him up, even if it's just his body.
I know. And D.B. Sweeney, he holds them to task about that.
Yep.
Later on. And, like, I don't blame him, because God damn it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was in plain view. He was just unconscious on the ground.
If I'm dead, you can leave me and go.
How would we know, though? Get a really long stick. And poke you.
I don't know. I think I'd be so mad if you
guys left
me.
And maybe at that point, the aliens are like, they're already being probed. This one's taken. Where do we go?
There's far less butt play in this movie.
I know I didn't have an anal probe, and I know that I am not under alien control.
I love to sing about the moon and the June and the spring. I love to sing about a sky of blue or a keyboard too.
What the hell was that?
He is under alien control. That thing in his butt is linked up to the visitor.
Son of a bitch.
So Robert Patrick finally goes back to pick him up because he's like, that was a totally dick move. And all the other guys, they don't want to go back. So they stand outside on the road until Robert Patrick comes back through. But Robert Patrick doesn't find D.B. Sweeney.
No, at this point, he's gone. So he's seemingly
gone.
The aliens, like, it was like a shoving match. Like, they pushed him down. Scared off everybody else.
And then like, we'll take you after all. It doesn't make any sense, actually.
Not really.
I don't know. That actually doesn't make any sense. I wish I hadn't thought of it. Anyway, Robert Patrick now takes the guys, and they come into town to tell their tale. And that's where Maverick comes in.
They make the call. They report it. There is like everybody's in legit shock.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the time they're trying to sort of drink the sorrow away, I guess, at the moment. But they do like go through official channels and report it, and of course, anybody who hears the story of an alien abduction in 1975 in the middle of Arizona, they're skeptical. And there's not enough to go on aside from their story and that this dude is missing. So they're not arrested.
Mm-hmm.
They are, you know, questioned and questioned again. And then we get into the gravitas given to the lie detector process.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is 1975. Present day, lie detectors are not admissible in court because they're acknowledged as being bullshit.
Right.
I think at best they were given a 50-50 likelihood of being accurate.
Yeah, you can make them say whatever you want them to say. The truth is whatever you want to believe it is.
Yeah, but they put so much onus on the professional coming into town.
That's because these guys in particular in real life both took two different lie detector tests and proved that their story to the lie detector test was true. And that's why they put so much emphasis on it in the film.
Yeah, and in the story up to this point, like, Robert Patrick, you know, at this point he's been gaslit by the whole town. Everybody is skeptical, and they think he might have even murdered his friend, and that's, you know, he finds that very offensive.
Except where he left him to die, so kind of he did.
So they're eager to clear their names. There's the one guy. Is it Dallas? He's raging douchebag.
Yeah, he's the crazy one.
And just whatever, having defiance disorder.
Oppositional defiance.
Oppositional, like, yeah, kind of reeks of that. And so the lie detector is meant to be the clearing their names, and when the professional who's administering the test is like, I don't know, I want to try it again, they're just like, no, they're so angry at that point, like they've had enough. It was a weird call to make on their part.
I don't know. I think I would be annoyed by that time too.
Annoyed, sure, but they outright refuse.
I think I might too. I'd be like so annoyed by the whole process. I'd be like, no, I already did this. I did that. Like, that's up to you guys. You're the fucking detectives.
I guess there isn't really escalation on the cops' part. They haven't really talked about arresting anybody. I guess it's also made difficult.
Because there's no body, so there's no crime, really.
Yeah. Yeah. So not long after that, I guess 5 days, right, after the initial abduction, collect call to the Patrick house in the middle of the night. And the voice sounds like D.B. Sweeney's voice, and he gives him a rough estimate of where he is. And when they do eventually find him, he's naked and terrified. And they give him the rattiest fucking blanket they could find.
Yeah, where did that blanket come from?
I kind of assume they put it on the back seat when they've got dogs in the car. Like, it looked like that. Like, it's ugly. It's like, the good news, welcome back to Earth. You're safe.
Here's
bad
a
news
bag.
Is you have smallpox. No, like, it's ugh. But so, yeah, D.B. Sweeney, I really liked the trauma component, the survivor component that D.B. Sweeney is portraying, because we watch him go from like rambunctious, young, energetic
young
guy,
buck.
And then he is decidedly haunted for the rest of the film, well, most of it. But he's got marks around his eyes and his mouth and his nose. Like, he got fucked up. We don't know what happened, but something terrible happened to him, and he is skittish and nervous. And oddly, when they do find him, they also give notice to the UFOologist who showed up in town, also curious to investigate. And that guy shows up, and he wants to interview him on the spot.
Right.
When clearly he's been traumatized.
And he just makes it worse.
How did they communicate with
just
you?
Stop it!
What is this man in the mirror about?
Okay, look, you've got two choices. You can either be quiet or step outside.
Dana, give this guy a chance.
Mr. Walton, can you tell me what they look like? Can you tell me how many of them there were? Were you given food? Injection?
All right, that's enough, mister.
Mike. It's important the entire world learns of your experience.
That's enough, Mike. Come on.
Look, I am asking you. I'm asking all of you. Just let us do our job.
No, you have done your thing. He's not asking you.
I'm between me and my brother.
Everybody's very excited to have him back in town. They throw him a welcome back party. And reminiscent of me as a little boy who would hide under furniture and when I didn't want to talk to people who were visiting the home, we find D.B. Sweeney under the kitchen table. and he's kind of like he's somewhere else entirely.
Right.
His eyes are
you're like
you know.
party's over.
Yeah.
The guest of honor is under the table.
On the table were like breakfast settings, and so there's a bottle of syrup that when he jars away from getting poked or whatever by his coming fiance, jostles the table, syrup falls over, yep. spills onto his face, and that induces a full-on flashback.
So I have a phobia
of syrup,
of stickiness. I have a great fear of being sticky. I don't like it in any way, shape, or form, but it's beyond like don't like it. I almost panic.
I just
in situations
recently
like that.
Re-listened to our own episode on slime. And I feel even better for the written intro where you cut into it and you're like, maybe people just don't like being sticky. Like, maybe it's gross.
I have like such a thing about it, and it's more than a dislike. And so that scene, I saw that syrup going and I was like, firstly, that table's going to be sticky as shit.
That's going to take forever to clean.
It's going to be disgusting, and now it's going to go on the floor, but then it falls on D.B. Sweeney. I would have shit my pants under that table.
Who's to say he didn't?
So now he has his flashback, and he's in this cool catacomb sort of...
The best part of the
movie. Gross thing.
Yeah. It's
so gross.
It's like a lower-tech version of the Matrix pods when they wake up in that goo.
Yeah, because we always expect that alien spaceships should be clean and futuristic.
Sterile, yeah.
This one is a fucking shithole. There's garbage everywhere. Because at one point, they're dragging him down the hallway, and there's just shit everywhere.
Yeah, my memory, and maybe I just missed it this time around, but my memory as a kid was that when he's bouncing around in zero gravity, he accidentally does protrude into another pod.
Yeah, he does, and he goes into their body.
Oh, there is. Okay, yeah.
He sticks his hand into this old dead body.
Okay, I just didn't notice it this time around.
And it's like guts are much like that mouse outside my house. Guts everywhere.
And other Dr. Seuss stories.
It's such like a great like filthy thing. You'd think it should be all silver and blue tones, but instead filth.
Apparently they took some leniencies between the like written accounts and what we see on camera, but I don't know, still compelling. I think in the struggle he knocks one of the helmets off of the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And so that alien doesn't make an effort to put the helmet back on, so we just are now eyeballing this gray who
is pink.
It
underneath, right?
Yeah, like dull pink.
He's gross looking
and has like a permanent grimace on his face, and that's just me anthropomorphizing.
Yeah, he just has like a mouth slot.
Yeah, I guess
of.
They don't really. Did they?
I don't
blink?
Like the looks.
I think
of
maybe
it.
They blink, but that might be about all the physicality of the face. But still creepy, way creepier than the communion aliens or the traditional grays that are just kind of the. The, you know, floating, wooing little guys. Yeah, in this case, the BDSM latex play to strap them down. That was unique. That was really compelling.
Very cool. Yeah. I used to work, when I was in college, my friend and I used to work at this print store, and we sold very expensive prints. Inexpensive prints that either we were shipping out to somewhere we had to do the vacuum seal.
Oh, yeah.
I loved doing that. It was my most favorite thing ever. And that was like a scene from that. Like they vacuum sealed that guy.
Did you ever use the laminating machine at work? I feel like that's...
No, that was like your job.
They essentially laminate D.B. Sweeney to keep him in place. And they give him slits so he can breathe. And then we engage the body horror component.
Yeah.
That's really, really impressive.
It's a god-awful small affair.
So we'll close it out there. We'll give you guys all the regular reminders that we are on all the social media. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Rance Macabre. And we were excited to see that Fangoria was purchased and revamped, and they're in the process of getting things started up again. And we're in communication to see where we land with them. Fingers crossed that works out. In other media news, we would recommend that you check out Grimm Magazine. It's a brand new magazine out of Canada, associated with some friends of ours up there. It's not exclusively that of a feminist perspective, but they certainly take it into account. They've got some pretty powerful writers there, and we have a little feature where
it was February's Women in Horror Month.
Yeah,
and so we're alongside some other podcasts that are awesome as well.
Yeah,
and so check us out.
We're also on Patreon at patreon.com/rantsmacabre, where we've got a whole other catalog of items, whether it's music, songs, sketches. What else? We've got like wholly produced episodes. We've got a two-parter and Last House on the Left. Yeah, we've got a lot of stuff there on Patreon. Give it a look.
Yeah, this month we're talking about The Ritual and The Cloverfield Paradox.
Yeah, new to Netflix, both of those. And yeah, good stuff. We always forget that in addition to being on iTunes, we also find it hugely useful to have you guys drop in and give us a review. We kind of dropped the ball in terms of asking for reviews.
Give
and
us
sort
stars.
Of
we want stars.
And on that, I will exit. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
The Rants Macabre. Cutting.
Cultured.
And curated. Curated.
I received this information from an alien. As I told my husband, it was in the Paramus Holiday Inn. I was having a drink at the bar, alone, and this alien approached me. He started talking to me. He bought me a drink, and then I think he must have used some kind of a ray or a mind control device because he forced me to follow him to his room. And that's where he told me about the end of the world.
So your alien had a room at the Holiday Inn, Paramus.
It might have been a room on the spacecraft made up to look like a room at the Holiday Inn. I can't be sure about that, Peter.
Of course not. And that is the whole problem with aliens, is you just can't trust them. Occasionally you meet a nice one, Starman, E.T., but usually they turn out to be some kind of big lizard. That's all the time we've got for this week on World of the Psychic. Next week, though, give me Ira. Hairless pets. Weird. Until then, this is Peter Venkman saying... See you then.